Hi, and welcome to the 100th episode of the Language Mandarins podcast. My name is Jonathan, and today on the show I have a special guest. Her name is Kara Leopold. So she's a fellow online teacher. How are you doing, Kara?
I'm all right. Yourself?
Not bad. Not bad. It's wonderful to have another guest here on the show celebrating 100 episodes. It's been kind of up and down over the past couple months, but I've managed to get up to this amount, so I want to keep going. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, and congratulations on so many episodes.
Yeah, it's just kind of persistence, not giving up, and so now it's kind of like want to kind of dedicate myself a little more to like interviews. I especially enjoy talking with fellow teachers. So I think that's where I'm going to maybe head towards a bit more of if there's a niche I can start to work on for these episodes. So, can you tell us a little bit your background? How long have you been teaching online and offline?
So I started teaching English. I got my first job when I moved to France in 2007. So I'm British, but I've lived in France since I finished my studies. And I worked pretty much full time for 4 years, and then I decided I fancied a change, so I went back to university. But I still did a little bit of English teaching on the side, but not necessarily full time. And then I came back into it full time, kind of towards the end of last year, and that's when I started getting into online teaching. So I've been, doing a bit of that since, October last year was when it started, when I had my first session on Skype with someone.
Have you been teaching through your own website or through another platform?
Good question. I've been doing it all kind of through my I didn't have my own sort of website in the beginning. I was really lucky. I have a friend, an American friend who lives in a town not too far from here. And she has a very successful offline business, and which means she's booked solid. And she had someone who had wanted to work with her for like 3 years or something crazy, but my friend never had any space. And also this person actually lives in the same city as me. So my friend gave me this referral, and I asked the person in question, well, do you fancy doing the lessons online? And she said yes, and it started from there. And then a sort of month or two later, I kind of sent an email out to some relevant contacts just explaining that I was getting into this online thing. And through that, I managed to get an ex-offline student into my online classes as well. So I had two people to kind of experiment on, and I was able to recruit them through my own network, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And how does offline and online teaching compare for you?
It's funny because I was doing them both at the same time, because also last year when I started online teaching, I also started working in a high school where I live in France. So that was something new because I've never worked in a high school before. So I was working offline with students and kind of getting back into teaching full time. But I've discovered that I feel that online teaching offers so many more opportunities with all the technology that's there. There's so many ways to personalize what you're doing, and the access to resources is amazing. Like, I can't believe that I used to teach with sort of bits of paper, photocopies, and students get so disorganized with all that, whereas when it's online, it's so much more seamless. You can share things, you can send things. I think I actually prefer it overall. For that kind of side of the experience, it's just easier to organize, no more paper. So many things you can do with like video and audio resources. So I'm totally converted now. I would have a hard time going back to just doing offline teaching.
Do you still have some offline students as well?
No, not at the moment. We'll have to see. I mean, I'm not ruling out the possibility that there will never be any more offline students, but I think I would teach in sort of a different way now, knowing what I know, or encourage people to go online if they're sort of hesitating or whatever.
So in that transition, were you converting a couple offline students to online as well?
No, because initially I wasn't sort of, I haven't been recruiting locally as such, but that's something I want to get into. But unfortunately, well, the problem that I've had is that because I hadn't been teaching for a few years, because I was kind of out of the game, I had lost contact with people, or I, you know, wasn't necessarily teaching one-on-one anymore. So I did contact some ex-students, but kind of things had moved on and they weren't maybe, you know, interested in lessons at that point. But I think it's always useful to keep people in the loop, because you never know. And I've been working a lot on networking and everything at the moment. But it's hard, like, it's crazy. When I used to work, I used to work in lots of different places, and people would just come. This is before I had like a business or kind of any idea of, you know, offering really my own sort of one-on-one classes in a structured way. People would be like, oh, you know, I know someone, their kid is doing their exams this year, they need an English teacher. And people would just walk up to me and just, you know, they didn't really, you know, they're just like, oh, you're a native English speaker, you can do it. I mean, it's insane. And I often think that I'm going to walk across the street to the bakery where I live and just put up a sign with a British flag on it saying English lessons, and I would have people calling me the same day. So it's funny, whereas when you move online, your visibility is not the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely easier if you're one of the few native speakers where you live, and yeah, people just automatically are like, you know, they want to do lessons with you. It's funny.
Yeah, with the visibility. I remember a funny time with you. Sometimes, yeah, when you're doing offline work, you don't know who knows you. And I was working in one office, a client office, and I started to at least work with like at least 20 people in there. And so people would see me, but I didn't necessarily know everybody there. And my son was born, and I had to take him for his first shots. Like, he was 1 week old. My wife was bedridden, obviously recovering. So I had to take my son. He was this tiny little baby. I had to take him to the hospital. I was completely a nervous wreck just to get him there. And we'd take the taxi, get there, get to the hospital. And I'm just almost in tears of like, I made it. I'm here sitting down.
Oh.
And next to me, this man looks over and says, are you an English teacher? And it just completely like threw me off guard completely. Like, how is that? How would you know that at all? And he's like, yeah, you work with so-and-so. I work in this office. I'm like, yeah, I've seen you around. And it just like completely threw me off. Like, I didn't expect to be networking in a hospital taking my son. And it turned out his daughter or son had just been born a few weeks earlier. And so we were kind of slightly bonding as kind of parents, and he could see that it was my first kid, but it was kind of just off, completely threw me off guard of networking in a hospital or something. But but yeah, you never know who knows you when you're teaching offline.
Yeah.
And for like new online teachers, what would be some advice that you would give for that kind of transition or getting the website up and running?
Oh, well, I think it's always good if you can find someone who'll kind of let you like experiment on them, if you see what I mean. Like, I mean, that could be like, I was lucky because I had one person who I gave classes to kind of for a lower cost than what I'm charging now. And then another one who I gave classes to in exchange for him doing various design bits of work for me. So I think you need to kind of maybe set up an arrangement like that, maybe with a former offline student or someone you know who wants English lessons, and just get started, just try it out. But if you're serious about it, then you'll need to very quickly start thinking about exactly what you're going to offer and who to. Because that's really what's going to set you apart, if you have a clear offer. And that actually helps with your visibility, So when you're working offline, well, you just have to be the English speaker in your town who gives lessons. You're probably going to, you know, get some clients in. Although even there, you need to have kind of your what you're known for. But whereas when you're online, you really need to be clear about exactly what you're doing, who you're serving, and how you do it, and that's how you get noticed. And that was really, like, I struggled with that in the beginning, and it sounded kind of counterintuitive to me that you had to narrow down what you were offering in order to find clients, because up to then I thought that, you know, one of my strengths as a teacher was the fact that I had worked with, you know, all ages, all levels, people from age 6 to 66, business people, students, you name it, I'd done it, and that was in quite a short span of time. So you think you're supposed to carry on in that vein, but because of the things you have to do when you're an online teacher and you're creating your brand and you're trying to bring in the people that you want to work with, in fact, you have to forget that mentality. But I think it's hard. It's hard for teachers coming from offline experiences where they've learned to work like that, or even who maybe have had successful offline businesses that have to work on, you know, narrowing down and really focusing on, you know, what they like doing and who they want to help. So, yeah, that's the big question to ask yourself, because that's going to lay the foundation for everything you're going to do afterwards. And, you know, for building a website, there's no point in doing that until you know who you're targeting, and then you can craft the message of the website around that.
Yeah, I still struggle with this too. And like, I've had my website since like almost a year ago. I think I got this set up like in September. Didn't really do much with it. Then I even started working, getting some students from another platform like Italki. And then when I kind of stopped working at an office job in February, then it was like, I need to go into this like full. But I'm still struggling to get students through my website. I've managed to get a business partner who is with like a study abroad website, and she's actually set up like a landing page, and then her network has been where I've gotten like a lot of my current students. But the bigger question is eventually, well, what am I doing with my own website? What am I doing for the niche? And yeah, like you said, when I was living in Paris, I started to work with primarily offline and doing students, high school students, university students, businesses. And then I specialized for businesses from like 2005 to 2008 when I was living there. And then since I've been in Mexico, I've been freelancing at businesses as well, up until like the Mexican market kind of just collapsed for me. And that's where I took on an office job. And then more recently realizing like, I'm not such a good office job person. I prefer to have a little more, go back to teaching, have a little more the independence. But yeah, like what you say, it's hard to go from that. I teach anybody, anywhere, any level, anything, be kind of versatile, and to realize that online, that's not very attractive. You kind of want to be known as a specialist in something. Yeah. And I think when you're starting to network with other teachers, I think the first reaction is like, we might feel like we're competing with each other. But once we know like your area of specialization is not mine, so then it's like, well, yeah, I could refer you for this type of task, and maybe you could refer me if I know what it is that I specialize in. So like, you can kind of like, if you were building a house, like contractors and unions, they're not allowed to do everything. They have to specialize. So it's like everybody comes together as a team to get some project done. But I think on the global market, I mean, there's no real competition, I guess. And I think one of the teachers that we're both familiar with, Jack Askew, I think he said something about this before, like there is no real competition. So that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy doing these interviews is kind of feeling how other teachers adapt to their online business and kind of what struggles they have as well. So.
Yeah, totally. No, I totally agree with that. That's a good analogy with the house building that, yeah, it's funny. It's so much easier to collaborate once everyone is clear on, you know, on what they're doing, the learners they prefer working with and you know, how they can help them. Yeah, I would have no hesitation. I would know exactly what to do or who to send someone to if they came to me saying their main problem was, I don't know, writing skills or giving presentations, or you know, I have people in my head who I would refer them to, and it's nice to know that you don't have to take on people who you can't help as well as you know, the ideal clients that you're looking for. So yeah, it's nice. It just makes it easier to run your business and and serve the people you want to serve.
Yeah, because I think ultimately, I mean, we're building these businesses based around like doing a service for a client. And I think also if you compare like the medical profession where everybody has a specialization. So, just in terms of like a doctor's sanity, if they had to take like every possible case, every possible situation and try to diagnose, treat, recommend, it becomes very tiring to try to know everything about everything. And I think for teachers, we kind of in a certain way kind of diagnose students' problems or issues or areas of opportunity and try to I know the perfect person you should talk to for that. Okay, I know here's a recommendation, go talk to this person. I think like when we look at it a different way like that, I think it it helps us kind of stay focused on who are we doing this for. We're kind of serving people, helping them, and try to getting them the best service they can do. And I think if we try to do everything, we might get spread thin on all the different areas. So where do you feel is your area of specialization?
Well, I've narrowed it down, if you like, to listening skills, and more specifically how to cope when you're an English learner who's been learning English for a long time. You can speak, you can make yourself understood, you can read, you can write, but you just struggle when you're faced with, I'm trying not to say native speakers too much. I would use the term fluent speakers, because fluent speakers can be native or non-native. And when you're faced with a conversation with these people, trying to follow them and keep up with them, can be a real struggle. So that's the kind of area I'm focusing on, helping people who, you know, have been studying for a long time but still can't crack the code of spoken English so that they can understand in effective ways.
Cool. And how do you feel like for listening skills, do you teach a little bit of pronunciation skills as well with that? How did that compare?
I think you have to bring in the pronunciation a little bit, definitely, because one of the techniques I think is interesting is shadow reading that we hear so much about. So you know, you do some listening work on a recording, and then you choose a section of it and you try to shadow the person you're listening to. So you're not repeating after, you're actually following them at the same time, and that forces you to adopt the rhythm and stress of that speaker. And that is going to make you more aware of of how to comprehend fluent or native speakers. So the two are just really intimately connected. I know now that if I had to learn another language, or if I wanted to, I think I would start with just learning the sound system, learning especially the sounds that are different to English or French. I have the advantage that I've got both, and then just focusing on those so that I'm able to recognize them and start to recognize, you know, basic word and sound patterns, the consonant clusters or the vowel sounds that could be different, and then just getting used to them. I think that's how I would work now, starting with sound pronunciation and listening first, and then building in the other areas of language. So
yeah, I definitely agree with the shadow speaking, shadow listening technique, because I recommend that as well with some students with working with like audiobooks, and then having the transcript and following along and then doing all the different exercises with that. But it's something that I think needs to be a little more like independent work, because I've tried doing that live a couple times, and it's kind of like musicians who don't know how to play together. Like, no, you first, and then you're waiting for the other person, and then no, you first. So sometimes when it's like the teacher and the student reading and trying to read at the same time, there's this like hesitation, like a pause becomes a really long pause. And so I think when you're listening to a recording, you have no choice but to adapt your speaking and your listening to that recording. And, but it's really cool because the students like instantly they lock in. Like you just, your intonation matches the recording, the pausing matches the recording. Again, it's like with music where you could have a recording and try to play back exactly as one of these kind of musicians you want to emulate. So I think it's a really good way to develop the listening skill and kind of take a model like of how you should sound, how you can speak. And in some cases, it kind of frees up the practice time with the teacher, so you can like primarily focus on maybe speaking and some of the listening skills independently. But
yeah, that's true. No, there's definitely activities like I think you can students can make quite big gains by themselves if they do their listening practice in the right way. And then something like a shadow reading, once the student has practice the same passage a few times, they can record themselves, they can, you know, then send it to the teacher for review rather than trying to do it in the same session. I think the presence of a teacher for listening skills is more useful when you're working on something I've been working on a lot is transcribing sections of recordings, so short sections, and then, you know, getting the student to compare that with the original and then working out, well, what's missing? What did you miss here? And then using the class session to actually analyze, okay, so in spoken English, these words are hard to hear, these words are unstressed, or, you know, very often I'm pointing out things like words that they already know but that are really reduced. Like one big problem is the word it, because we never say it, it sounds more like it, or, you know, and it's, yeah, it can be puzzling to discover that, you know, one word can have one two-letter single-syllable word can sound so different to how you were expecting it to sound. And that is valid not just for all the grammatical words like auxiliaries or articles and things like that, but even some content words can be reduced in fast speech. I mean, we know about examples like when people say, actually, and it sounds like Ashley, but there are loads of other content words where you can get rid of a syllable when you're speaking fast, or the end of the word comes off, you can't hear it. There's all kinds of crazy things that happen when people speak fast, and you know, I think teachers need to be there to you know, analyze that with students and kind of explain why that goes on, and just make them aware of all the possibilities, you know, of words they know and how they can sound in speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I struggled a bit when I was in France with trying to teach some of the students the kind of these reduced forms, and because in a certain section of the population, like it was, at least for living in Paris, it was the people who were living outside of Paris in the banlieue, they would have a style of speaking. And so instantly, if you were speaking that way in a business situation, in business French, it would be really out of place to use some of those reduced forms. Like if you're having this like, je sais pas, instead of like a je ne sais pas or je sais pas, it sometimes would be using a certain vocabulary, using a certain pronunciation, people would kind of base this on like a class class distinction or maybe education level distinction. And I have a hard time teaching some of these students, like, no, this is something that like everybody does. Like, here, let's listen to a speech by Obama. I mean, Obama wasn't president at the time, but let's listen to a speech by President Bush. But then maybe people didn't have a favorable opinion of him, so it wasn't such the like the best example to say. But like, okay, everybody uses these
Reduced.
reduced forms of gonna, wanna, have to, shunta, things like that. And but it was hard to kind of convince them of like. So I had to come up with like a negotiated midway of saying like, you don't have to use them when you're speaking, but at least from a listening perspective, you need to
Be
recognize
aware.
them. You need to be aware of what these words
It's all
sound
about
like. Yeah.
it's all about awareness. I mean, even if students still kind of have trouble, even just reducing their grammatical words and replacing the vowels with schwa, I mean, it's not so bad, but they have to know that in speech they're not going to sound that way. I'm shocked when I listen back to my podcasts about all the different ways I pronounce words like and, just all the variations with the d disappears, the a disappears, and even when it's just reduced to n, it sounds really, it's almost imperceptible and it's crazy. And that's just one speaker across a few minutes. You need to know awareness is key, really. But yeah, also and also making people aware of like, yeah, that it can happen even in more careful delivery. There's always going to be unstressed words. Maybe they won't get reduced as much as in, fast conversational English, but you have to be aware of it. So
Do you teach phonetics to your students or try to teach some kind of approximations, or what do you feel is more appropriate?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it is worth using the phonemic chart just to, because it's a good way of visually showing, oh, here's this sound that disappeared, or in the word but the t became a glottal stop and it became but, and that's something I've been thinking about actually, because I did a podcast recently about Scottish accents and one of the characteristics is the glottal stop in the middle and at the end of words to replace the t sound, and you hear that as that it's a feature of Scottish accents or maybe uneducated accents or speech that's not careful. And I don't think that's true. I mean, even people with other accents, a lot of the time when they're saying words like but or that in fast speech, they sound, they are saying glottals because they're saying but that what and that, regardless of their accent. So yeah, that does annoy me that, your example with the shipa, people have weird perceptions of like how they, how they think they speak and how they really speak, and they're not aware of how their spoken language sounds. But I digress from the original question. But yeah, I think it is worth introducing the students to a few symbols. I mean, not all of them are relevant, but yeah, I think it's a useful shorthand. Especially because, a lot of the consonant sounds, they look like the letters anyway, but you do just have to make them aware that, for example, it's not a letter, it is a sound. So, yeah.
Yeah, the difference between a letter, a digraph, and is it, or is this really a digraph, or this is two letters? But yeah, the phonetics sometimes helps like that. One of my favorite apps is the Macmillan Sounds app, and that's
Oh,
for
yeah.
like the iTunes or iPhone, the Android as well. And I usually recommend that to some students, but sometimes the words that they give for transcription end up being like really long words, and then as students are getting kind of immersed in just the symbols, it may be easier just to focus on like a one syllable word or a whole list of one syllable, so they get kind of used to the symbols and then the benefits of it for the recognition. Because I remember when I was in my fourth year level of French at the university, when I was in California, my teacher taught me phonetics, French phonetics, and it was just an eye opener, because at that point I got really frustrated with my previous teachers who were not native speakers and saying, like, why didn't anybody teach me that I had bad pronunciation in French? And it was just this awareness of, like, okay, we're going to transcribe these basic words, like you're saying, of, I know how to say un tour. And I was like, I think I know how to pronounce that oo sound correctly, because that's the problem. And then I start comparing this to other words, or like feuille, like for page or leaf, and like, well, how is that really pronounced? And then I started going into the phonetic transcriptions and going, like, that symbol doesn't represent that sound. And then I would compare it to another word and go, like, that word doesn't, like, that, I thought these two words rhymed, but they're not, they're separate. So I realized, like, my pronunciation was a bit of a mess. So I had to get all, like, the vowel sounds separated and started kind of putting the apples with the apples, the oranges with the oranges, and then realizing, like, wow, okay, the phonetics was, like, a clear, objective way to see the pronunciation. And then when I started teaching English more and realizing, like, yeah, I can still use these phonetic symbols because it's meant to be universal. It's meant to be for the, like, the international phonetic alphabet. So now when I'm learning a couple foreign languages, I'm trying to look for, like, a phonetic transcription of some of the new words. So I know, like, okay, I know these symbols. I can start to predict how something should sound. And then later for my listening skills, based on, I know how this should sound, I know how to interpret some of these words. So yeah. it does definitely help going both ways for the pronunciation and the listening.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way to work. I had the same problem, really, like, learning French at school. We never really got any, like, maybe a little bit of remedial, like, pronunciation help, but I certainly knew, like, nothing really about the sound system of French. I just knew that I couldn't understand some stuff, or that people couldn't understand me. I just remember one day our teacher said to us, because we were, there were only two of us in, like, our high school class, so, you know, it's basically like private classes, so in theory you should make a lot of progress, and we did, but what was it I said, or the other girl in the class said, quand il, without the liaison, and our teacher just said, les filles, you don't say quand il, you don't, it's not a de, you say cantine, and you link it, and it's a t, cantine, quand ils viennent, I don't know, whatever the rest of the sentence was, and I was like, what, why are you telling me this now, like, that's so much easier to say, and it sounds so much more natural as well, and I mean, if someone had taught me about, you know, liaison between words in French earlier on, like, I would have understood so much more, and I would have had fewer, like, embarrassing experiences with not being able to make myself understood. And I've just had to learn all that, like, by osmosis. It does eventually get into your brain, but I mean, you know, I've been living abroad for 9 years. Not everybody has 9 years to, well, it didn't take 9 years, but you know what I mean, like, you can't just go to the other country. There's faster ways of doing it, basically. Developing your listening skills and the pronunciation to go with it.
Yeah, I've been working with one student recently to help teach some French, and I recognize it's just, like, I keep apologizing and saying, like, I'm sorry, the French language is a bit of a pain for the pronunciation at the beginning, and, like, we'll say just the basic verbs of, like, être, avoir, and savoir, and it's like, okay, ils ont, or ils sont. And it's like, okay, well, which one is it? Is it they are, or is it they have? And then it's, what was the other one with, like, with savoir, there's something of, like, vous avez and vous savez, of, like, you know, or you have. Yeah, and so, like, everything gets kind of mixed in there. And it's like, if you don't do the liaison, or you switch the Z sound for the S sound, and it's like, you're completely switching verbs.
And that's just with the most basic verbs that you would start off teaching somebody. Or, like, my boyfriend laughed at me because I was saying, what was I saying? I was saying un oiseau, or les, and not making the liaison. And he was like, you sound like an idiot. You sound like a little kid. J'ai vu un oiseau, les oiseaux. And I was like, what? How am I? And he said to me though that he says some liaisons are just kind of personal preference. So there are probably some that I make now because maybe I've heard the people around me making them, or you know, there are rules, but some of them are kind of, it's maybe the situation or personal preference or you know. But yeah, that example with a bird, was you know, it's yeah. It's funny, you don't realize how significant it is. You're like, well, I'm saying, you know, that's to me it sounds okay, but
And do you apply those kind of awareness realizations to when you're teaching your students of like, okay, I'm going to give you the best tips to make sure you're aware of these things in English.
yeah, well, like one thing we've done which I think is effective and I want to do more of is using transcripts of recordings actually before listening and sort of predicting what you think is going to happen. So once you've taught students a few connected speech rules to do with, you know, reduced sounds or linking sounds or elision or things like that, then you can get them to just with a short extract, just maybe predict what's going to happen and then compare. Did your predictions come true? You know, were there glottal stops where you expected them? Were these words reduced or were they in fact pronounced in a strong version because the speaker wanted to put emphasis on them? I think that's a really and it's hard at first, but it's a really good awareness raiser. So anything with like transcripts like that, either predicting how words are going to be pronounced, or listening and then transcribing and then kind of analyzing the other way around. They're both really good awareness raisers.
Yeah, I think I like that approach of having like an hypothesis and then kind of testing it, predicting what's going to happen. Because I think sometimes with the listening skills, it's a little bit more reactive and then kind of figuring out like, why didn't I understand that person? But I think if you can know some of this information in advance, you can kind of like, oh, that person is from this country or this region. Maybe I can anticipate how they're going to speak. So you can kind of prepare the terrain, I guess, for the listening skills.
Oh yeah, definitely. You can preempt some things, you know. Yeah, with regard to accent, with regard to also depending on the type of extract, you know, is it a TED talk? So is the delivery maybe a bit more careful? Is it an interview with spontaneous English? And just kind of take a look at you know, at the differences. And I think it's also worth as well making students aware of the differences between written and spoken language. So I've already had it pointed out to me, you know, oh, I found this speaker hard to understand because she starts her sentences, then she changes her mind, or you know. And I was like, well, that's spoken English, so you're making it up as you go along and you haven't pre-planned it. And so you know, there will be mistakes, there will be grammatical errors, there will be kind of yeah non-standard grammar really, I would call it, just all these things that you're not used to. And again, I'm trying to make students more aware of that too when we you know, go into kind of analyzing transcripts and looking at, you know, examples of language use, vague language that you know using filler expressions like that. These are all things to be aware of because I think a lot of students don't realize kind of just how different written and spoken language are, and even how different varieties of spoken language can be. Like I've been listening to some business podcasts recently, and there are definitely one or two where they've pre-written the transcript of what they're going to read, and so the delivery is just everything about it suggests that it's not some spontaneous speech. And I think that's really interesting. You know, it's fascinating. It's kind of linguistics 101. I know that this is the kind of thing I had to do in the first year of studying linguistics. You had to find like a written text and a spoken text and then compare them and analyze them. But it is a really enlightening activity. But I think a lot of people aren't even aware of the, in you know, in their own language, really, of how they really sound when they speak spontaneously, and how that can differ from, you know, a written version of their thoughts or something planned like a presentation. So yeah, it's all about awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely agree. Like, this would be, like, I think linguistics and phonetics should not necessarily be like year four material. I think some of these techniques should be in there of like level one, maybe not bombarding the students with everything, but at least of like, here's a little piece of knowledge, here's a little, another piece and a little piece. And I know like with some of the method books that I've seen, like I think New Headway or American Headway, I think they do a good job of introducing little bits and pieces of the phonetics and intonation and how this affects like asking questions or giving a negative response. And so I think it helps some of the students get some of the bite-sized pieces of some of these technical terms, but not in a manageable way. What would be some of the resources you would recommend for, let's say, teachers who want to learn these technical terms and things for phonetics? Are there resources that you've used that you recommend?
I really like Mark Hancock and Annie McDonald's website, which I cannot remember the name of. Just next to me, I have a copy of English Pronunciation and Use, which is a book written by Mark Hancock. I mean, that book is almost, like half of it is actually about listening, really. I mean, there are like obviously diagrams of the sounds and how to pronounce them because it is a self-study book for English learners. But then a lot of sections where he talks about connected speech or unstressed sounds and words, I mean, it points out in the book that it doesn't matter if you can't pronounce it this way, but you have to be aware for your listening skills that this is how people speak. And then on the Hancock McDonald website, maybe it is just Hancock McDonald, I can't remember. They have some downloadable exercises which are on the theme of pronunciation for listening. So not pronunciation for clear speech, which is kind of the model we see everywhere, but actually for learning how to listen, what happens to sounds when people are speaking, especially when they're speaking fast. So they have some nice resources. They're a bit more for offline use, but you could definitely get some inspiration from them. And also Mark Hancock has a really interesting version of the phonemic chart. So there's like Adrian Underhill's version, which I think everyone has kind of seen, where he has like, it's like the vowel sounds organized, like it starts with and then it goes to E, and the vowels and consonants, that you've got the vowels, the diphthongs and the consonants all organized in a certain way. And then Mark Hancock has done it like a different way. It kind of looks like a flower. I think his way is really good. And he has some nice diagrams with cats doing different stretches to show the tongue positions for different vowel sounds. I like those. If you want something like visual for your students, I think those are pretty good. And at the moment I'm reading a book by a guy called Richard Caldwell called Phonology for Listening. So that's a book, yeah, really all about these issues, sort of going beyond what he calls the clear speech pronunciation model into, I think he refers to it as the jungle when he talks about like how people actually speak, you know, in real life. Even some of the rules that we learn to do with connected speech or unstressed words break down because just kind of anything goes. So in that book, he kind of gives teachers and students like a model for analyzing spoken language, and it's called The Window on Speech. And it's about like focusing on just short extracts and looking at what like speakers choose to give prominence to when they speak. It's really fascinating. I'm still kind of working through it and hoping to bring some of that insight into my classes. So that's a couple of the resources. I can give you a couple more if you want to stick them under the.
Yeah, sure. It'd be great to include podcast. A couple with the show notes to help teachers and students. Right? Mm. Cool. Do you have any e-products, e-services that you're currently promoting for your students?
I'm working on a kind of project that will hopefully come to fruition in the next kind of sort of going into September, October, which is to kind of create a little listening test that people can speak and that people can speak, that people can purchase, and then like it'll be like a kind of evaluation that I'm going to give students, just to let them kind of assess their listening level in a like a kind of automated way. And for the moment, I'm kind of offering that as a more face-to-face thing. So if you go on my site, you can book what I call a listening lesson taster with me. So basically, it's like a getting to know you session where I show you kind of how I work and how you can actually learn listening in a lesson, because I think maybe it's a bit odd, the concept, because learners think, well, listening, I just do that by myself and one day I'll just magically know how to understand everything. And while that's true to a certain extent, it can be useful to get a bit of help just breaking down all these difficulties of the spoken language, just to help you go a bit faster. So I've got that, I've got my listening lessons, and I'm going to be doing an interview with one of my learners soon where she's going to talk about her experiences, so hopefully that'll be helpful. And I have on my website a little free guide that I've created, which is to help learners. It's like a self-study guide for improving your understanding of conversational English. So I share some activities and resources with you that will help you understand that particular variety of spoken in English, because it's conversational English really that I think all learners want to ultimately understand, because it's the can be the most rapid, the most spontaneous. That's where spoken English goes kind of crazy and unpredictable. So yeah, that's why I'm focusing on that. So
that's cool. So what is your website, the link?
Okay, so it's www.leo-, so that was very clever to put hyphen in my domain name, Leopold, like listening, sorry. So leo-listening.com. Okay. So Leo like Leopold, listening like listening, but with the hyphen in the middle. So I think you should probably put it in your show notes so that people don't make the mistake. Although if you do just type Leo listening all one word into Google, I believe I am the first search result. So that's another way to find me.
And on social media, which ones do you use?
I have a Facebook page where I share various resources to help you with listening. And then I've also started, it was only last week that I started getting onto Instagram to give like bite-sized listening practice every day. So explaining how words really sound when they're pronounced fast, doing dictation exercises, talking about different accents. So my handle is Understand Spoken English. And it's just nice short videos so you can do a bit of listening and discover various secrets of the spoken English language daily.
Cool. Okay. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you and hearing about your experience with online teaching, transitioning, and listening about the listening to your listening skills, recommendations. And I think that it's like a whole world, I think, in the listening section. So there's a lot to talk about, a lot to develop. So I wish you the best with that. And so I'll be looking at your materials and definitely recommending students check you out.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate it. Lovely talking to you. Thanks.
Yeah. So we'll be in touch, and I know we are in different Facebook groups together. So it's nice to get your feedback and comments on these similar topics. So it's a pleasure networking with you. So thanks again for coming on the show, and
thanks for having me.
Take care.
All right. You too. Bye.
Bye.